Morning, counsel. Thanks for joining us today by way of Zoom. So the first case we have is docket number 20-1304, United States versus Kirshner. And sir, am I pronouncing your name right? Lowry?
It's actually Lockery, Your Honor.
Lockery.
Yes, yes.
Good morning, Mr. Lockery. Whenever you're ready, sir.
Very good, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, I represent Jonathan Kirshner in this case, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you. Jonathan Kirshner, excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm battling a little bit of laryngitis, but I'll do the best I can. Jonathan Kirshner sold a very small number of counterfeit coins from his collection. In an investigation that spanned a number of months, I think the government proved up 3 or 4 transactions, which led to an actual loss calculation of a bit north of $14,000.
So Mr. Lockhart, we're familiar with the facts. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be in everybody's best interest if you focused on the loss calculation.
Yes.
So why don't you address that argument first and what issues you might take?
Sure, the loss calculation really in this case depends upon the so-called intended loss that the sentencing court found. And that's the concept of intended loss obviously has a definition in the application note. It means the pecuniary harm that the defendant purposely sought to inflict. Now, what the sentencing court did, I would call adjudication by assumption. The court assumed that because Mr. Kirshner had many, many coins in his collection, and some of them, if they were genuine, would have been in the stratosphere of a value of a counterfeit coin. The court assumed that he would, at some point in the future, attempt to sell all of those coins, and further, that he would attempt to sell them for a value approximating what the government expert at the sentencing hearing testified to. And that really made an assumption, a further assumption that Mr. Kirshner knew what those values would be. Those are all assumptions that the record really does not justify a finding about. Mr. Kirshner never attempted to sell anything beyond these very low priced coins that he marketed in the actual transactions we know about. The pre-sentence report said that there were records found in search of his house that suggested a much larger number of sales, but the average value on those sales, according to the government's calculation, was $90 per item. And when we have that as the factual background of what Mr. Kirshner actually did, there's really no basis to take the leap from the actual losses he attempted to, or that he actually inflicted, and to a point where we go up to $35 million and even north of $35 million to suggest that that was his purposeful, subjective intent to.
So are you suggesting that the loss should be capped at the amount of $14,600?
Well, what I think I have to suggest, given the presentation that the defense counsel made at sentencing, is that they had their own expert report where they came up with what that expert thought were some reasonable values. And I think it was $1.2 million that expert came up with. And that was the proposal that the defense made in front of the sentencing court. So I'm not sure that I could do much to depart from that. But that obviously was a far cry from the $35 or the $44 million figures that the government and the court we're dealing with, and ultimately that the court imposed.
Mr. Lockery, let's say the district court found, based on the evidence, that Mr. Kirshner intended to sell all of his coins, including the super rare ones, mm-hmm. and that he intended to sell them for as much as he could get. With that established, how's it unreasonable then to infer that the correct number is $35 or $45 million?
Well, we don't know that Mr. Kirshner had any information about those super high values. He didn't have an expert in tow to tell him the history, the complicated history, for example, of the 1933 St. Gaudens $20 coins, the one that was sold to King Farouk of Egypt for $7 million. He may or may not have known those things, but there's no evidence in the record that he was even aware of those valuations. So how could we then say that that's what he intended, that's the loss he intended to inflict? And that really is the standard under this application note.
If his intent was, I'll sell them for as much as I can get, then the question is, how do you put a dollar amount on them? And why is it unreasonable for the district court to do it the way that it did?
Well, it took the expert's testimony, but of course that expert's testimony was, actually it was quite a lot of cross-examination about it. And whatever inferences the judge drew from it, it seems a great leap from that inference that the expert came up with some kind of a reasonable view based on his decades of experience in the numismatics field, that somehow would be within the consciousness and within the awareness of, within the intention of Mr. Kirshner. And what we're trying to do here is to penalize wrongful intent and to penalize it to a sensible and reasonable maximum, perhaps, but how to translate that expert's view of these particular coins. I think there were probably 12 coins really an issue here. The 9 coins that were $2 million apiece, according to the expert, and 3 that were $8 million apiece. How to translate that into an actual intent, subjective, purposeful intent by Mr. Kirshner. I think that's a chasm one cannot cross. That's my sense of that issue, Judge.
Okay. But you're not are you quibbling with the government's experts' calculations? The judge accepted those calculations.
He accepted those calculations, although I will point out that the defense counsel, I think in a very able way, showed that there were some unrealistic kind of assumptions that the expert was making. For example, the expert had to concede that nobody was going to most likely sell one of these coins out the back of the car, out of the trunk of one's car in a public parking lot. We have an expert who comes in and says, well, the sale of these kinds of multi-million dollar items generally either happens through some kind of rarefied atmospheric public auction at Sotheby's, or more to the point, some kind of private sale at the upper levels of coin trading with all kinds of experts in place to ferret out fakes, and that these would have been easily ferreted out. And there was really no evidence that Mr. Kirshner had any access to that level of activity, that sort of stratospheric part of the of the coin market. That simply was not the playing field on which he was playing. And I think the expert conceded that. So what we have...
Wait a second. You complain about district court's estimate, but you didn't offer an alternative at sentencing. So if we remand, how can the district court possibly figure out a number?
Well, actually, the defense attended an expert's report during the sentencing, and it's in the record, it's in the appendix.
But that report assumed that he planned to resell them as acknowledged replicas. Let's assume the district court was reasonable in finding that he plans to sell them as genuine coins. You didn't offer evidence of what that valuation would be.
I think that's correct. I think that's probably correct. I'm not sure the defense expert reached that far.
So how's the district court supposed to find this out on remand? If we say it's reasonable for the district court to find that he meant to sell these as real, what's the district court supposed to do? If this is a clear error, then what wouldn't be a clear error?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Your Honor? I didn't quite get that.
Assume that the district court is reasonable in rejecting your contention that he intended to sell these as replicas. And the district court was not clearly erroneous in finding he intended to sell them as real coins. Mm-hmm. The only evidence you tendered was how much they would sell for as authorized replicas. So if we remand and we say a 23% haircut is not a reasonable methodology, how can the district court figure out a number on remand? If they're not taking your number in the report, they're not taking the government's 23% haircut, how's the district court supposed to figure out how much selling these coins as genuine, how much that loss figure would be?
I think it's a very difficult errand for the district court. And I think the difficulty of that errand, and there may not be a way to do it fairly in this case, the difficulty of that errand illustrates the unfairness of saddling this defendant with this level 22, it was when you add all the guideline levels in, the exceedingly high guideline range that came from this $35 million figure, when there's really nothing but speculation for people to engage in terms of what would be the purposeful conscious object of the defendant in all these circumstances. I don't think this record allows that kind of calculation. It's not, after all, the government has the burden of proof. And I think one of our cases says that the defense in these cases may have some burden of coming forward, but in the end, the government has the burden of persuasion. And so, this is simply not a case that lends itself to that kind of outcome.
We've adopted a burden shifting framework, so the government has to make a prima facie case. Once it does that, does your client then have to come forward with evidence of what his intent was, or is it sufficient for him to just poke holes in the government's prima facie case?
I think it's sufficient for him to poke holes in the government's prima facie case and illustrated shortcomings. And I think it's the Mims case, I have it written down here somewhere, where the Third Circuit has said that even though we have some responsibility on the part of the defense to raise issues, in the end, the government has a burden of persuasion that does not go away.
And do you accept that the government has made its prima facie case?
I don't. No, I think the evidence that they brought forward under the appropriate legal standards and the terms of the application note does not touch the issue of what Mr. Kirshner subjectively intended with respect to this, all these other coins, 35 million. People buy these. It's not a crime to buy these counterfeits. It's not a crime to have them. It's a crime to market them. And he never did. He never offered them to anybody. And so we're essentially penalizing him for something that he never even made an attempt to do. And remember, this is the highest level of criminal intent under our law. I think that Judge Gorsuch, when he was Judge Gorsuch in the 10th Circuit in the Manitow case, made clear that the words of this application note have to be given their normal and ordinary meaning. And what that leads to is the requirement that the government show an absolute conscious, purposeful object to inflict this particular level of pecuniary loss, even though the defendant did not succeed in doing so. It seems to me that to illustrate my point here, I would reflect for a moment on a case like the Geavers case, which is the Third Circuit case. In that case, the defendant had deposited bogus checks for, I think, up to $2 million in a variety of banks. And it was a check cutting scheme, basically. In the end, he attempted withdrawals of $400,000. He succeeded to the tune of $160,000. And at sentencing, there was a contest about what ought to be the intended loss, if you will. And the court said, well, we're gonna put that at $2 million because that's the level of checks. That's the amount of the checks he wrote. He wrote those checks and he deposited them in the banks. He took these affirmative steps with respect to those items that would add to that figure. Mr. Kirshner never took any affirmative steps with respect to these counterfeit coins of where the genuine variety was in the millions of dollars of worth. He never took any affirmative steps with those.
But sir, isn't it true that his bail was revoked for taking affirmative steps for violating? Isn't it true that his bail was revoked for violating the terms of a supervised release that was tethered to coin trading?
There was a violation, and my recollection of that is that he engaged in some kind of activity, either trying to make another sale or at least gathering some materials to do so. Yes, I think that's correct. Once again, though, I don't think that what happened there has much to do at all with whether he ever had a subjective intent to try to carry off a $2 million sale of one of those $1 coins or an $8 million sale of the 1933 St. Gaudens $20 coin. It doesn't seem like there's any evidence of him ever making such an attempt.
Right.
Not even getting within shouting distance of it.
So I think we understand your argument. We'll have you back up here on rebuttal soon.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is it Ms. Lorber?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Excuse me, that's my timer. Assistant United States Attorney Molly Lorber.
Do you want to pick up your timer?
Oh, it's all right, Your Honor. I can still see it. Right. Thank you. So first of all, I think given Your Honor's questions, it's important first to state what the appropriate standard of review is here. And that is, as some of your Honor's previous questions suggested, clear error. This is a factual determination. And this court's prior cases are quite clear that the determination of an intended loss amount is a factual determination, and it's reviewed on appeal for clear error.
let's grant you that. Let's talk about the record. Is there any evidence of the record that Kirshner knew the value of the most expensive coins?
No, Your Honor. I would say that there is not specific evidence of record that he knew the value of the very rarest.
All right. Any record evidence that he planned to auction the fakes as opposed to sell them in a Costco parking lot?
No, Your Honor. His modus operandi was not to engage in fancy auctions.
Any evidence that he thought his coins could fool an expert authenticator?
Well, certainly we do have some evidence of that, Your Honor. He didn't just import these coins in and of themselves. He also imported them with very sophisticated packaging that the expert who testified at sentencing testified was in fact so sophisticated that some experts were unable to determine that the coins were in fact fake, and they used it at a museum exhibit.
So that might help you on value, but there's a problem with that also supporting sophisticated means enhancement, which requires the defendant intentionally engaged in the conduct, but he didn't create this packaging himself. So maybe that helps your valuation, but that causes some problems for this if it's the basis for the sophisticated means enhancement then.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, although he didn't create the packaging, he used it, and he used it in his fraud, and he used it to dupe victims. Additionally, he did, if Your Honor would like to talk about sophisticated means, he set up false business entities. He used multiple.
You've got some other bases, but this one, there's room for arguing whether he engaged in the packaging or just used someone else's. Let's go back to valuation. Any evidence in the record that he thought he could get a 23% discount even as the market value increased 1,000-fold?
Well, Your Honor, what we have is only his past conduct. And what we have from his own invoices and from the sales that he actually conducted with what I'll call the live victims, was that he took approximately 23% off the fair market value when taken as an aggregate.
All right. Okay, let me go to another issue on loss. Why should Kirshner's sentence turn on his intended loss? The text of the guidelines just says loss. The commentary refers to intended loss. And as you know, we just had the Nasir case, now we have these Kaiser deference issues. How is it that intended loss is a reasonable interpretation of loss?
So, Your Honor, I don't wish to sidestep that question, but what I do want to say is this. With respect to the Nasir question about a conflict between the application notes versus the text of the guideline, as Your Honor may be aware, Nasir came out well after briefing, well, not well, but several weeks after briefing was concluded in this case. That question of interpretation was never raised before the district court, and it wasn't addressed in any of the briefing.
All right, so there's a forfeiture issue here. Maybe exactly. It's forfeited, maybe it's not preserved properly. If it were, would you argue that it was a reasonable interpretation of loss?
So, Your Honor, I would argue that it's reasonable, but what I would request is that we be given an opportunity for supplemental briefing on that issue, as it is new in light of Nasir.
Okay. Right, and we might or might not have to reach that, you know, but okay, that's helpful.
On the valuation question, Judge Bibas asked about the 23% discount, and your answer was, well, that's what he sold his previous coins for, was a 23% discount. But can you explain how it's reasonable to just carry over that 23% discount from $100 coins to multi-million dollar coins? Why does that translate automatically?
Well, I wouldn't say that it translates automatically, Your Honor. But what I would say here is that here on clear error review, what we have to do is look at whether what the district court did was reasonable, given the evidence that the district court had in front of it at the time and the arguments that were made to the district court at the time. And what the district court had was, as Your Honor noted, a burden shifting analysis. The government came forward with a prima facie evidence to prove by a preponderance of the evidence what this intended loss amount was. And I think it was a reasonable way of going about attempting to make that calculation, the government said, yes, Your Honor.
That's the nub of my question. Well, I'm not sure I agree with you that it was reasonable. So can you explain why it was, especially when our cases say at this very point in the analysis, the district court has to get into a deeper analysis. I'm not sure I see the deeper analysis here, but maybe you can help.
So what I will say is that the record before the district court, we didn't have, as my opponent points out, and as Judge Bibas points out, an auction. We didn't have a completed attempt or a near attempt to sell the very most valuable of the coins. So we had to, and the district court had to extrapolate from the evidence of record that it did have what the appropriate valuation would be. Well, and what the district court did was not just guess.
Let me stop you there for a second, because that's where I'm having an issue. So the record, as I understand it, were a couple of sales in the parking lot of a Costco to literally selling out of his car, and folks would meet him at a box store. Was it a reasonable extrapolation? And the judge, as I remember the record, said that that established a pattern of sales. Is it reasonable from that pattern of sales in a box store to extrapolate that this individual had the ability, intent, whatever, to sell coins to Saudi royals?
So, Your Honor,
is that a reasonable leap of faith?
So I believe it's reasonable here only because we have the issue of impossibility as noted in the application notes of the guidelines. And the district court was faced with a situation where although it might have been literally impossible for Mr. Kirshner to sell a coin for $8 million, we have a situation where, as the case law from this circuit states, I believe it was Givers, there's impossibility, but that doesn't mean, and expectation, but that doesn't mean he's not going to try to get as much as he possibly can. Just because it's impossible for him to get it doesn't mean he's not going to try to get as much as he possibly can.
And so it's reasonable then to assume he was going to take just a 23% haircut on the potential sale, as impossible as it might be, of these coins.
Correct, Your Honor. At least under the text of the guidelines as supplemented by the commentary.
What if we disagree that the 23% haircut is reasonable? What would you do on remand to establish a more realistic valuation?
Well, I think that the record might have to be supplemented. If Your Honor disagrees with the mechanics of the calculation, I think that leaves us in quite a difficult pickle, Your Honor, in that these types of mechanical evaluations really are the domain of the district court with all of the evidence before it. And, you know, if we want to come up with some other method of calculation or some other type of calculation, I'm not sure that we're able to do that on the record as it currently exists. And that was the record before the district court. Right. And since what we're doing here is evaluating whether the district court did was reasonable, right, I think we're a bit stuck with that.
Okay. Well, let's say we vacate and remand. What would you, do you have another way you could establish valuation?
You
have an opportunity to add more to the record. I don't know, maybe you don't know, but if you have any thoughts on what you would do.
Well, you know, what I would do, Your Honor, is put forth the same calculations in that it's my job here on appeal to attempt to uphold what the district court did here. I think given the expert evaluations, I'm not sure what other recourse the district court had here. Unless you wanted to just simply exclude those extremely valuable coins altogether. And that didn't seem appropriate in that there was every indication from the record that this defendant intended to sell each and every of his coins.
He used the same, the court used the same 23% haircut on those other coins as assuming it would be the same sort of transaction as this deal in the parking lot.
Yes, Your Honor, that's accurate. That's an accurate statement of what the district court did.
Thank you. Judge Porter, anything else?
No, thanks.
Judge Bibas?
Nope.
Thank you very much.
May I make one comment, Your Honor?
This is your rebuttal time, my friend.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to comment on this impossibility issue as raised in the application note. The fact that there might be some impossibility aspects to a record does not solve the initial problem of what the actual subjective intent of the defendant was. And I think if you look at the two examples that the Sentencing Commission puts in the application note, which all of us, I think, can agree in the wake of Nassar, we need to look carefully at the wording, both of an agency regulation and guideline and the application note, and apply the doctrine of lenity when we should. But if you look at the two examples that they give, the one is a sting operation where there's no question for the defendant to be found guilty or to plead guilty, he has to agree that he assented to a particular plan to steal a particular sum. It's a mythical, fictional amount that never existed. It would be impossible for them to actually impose that loss. But he signed on to a plan to do that. I mean, in the same kind of way that you can say about Mr. Geavers, he signed on to the maximum face value of all the checks he deposited, and he wrote them. He put the numbers on there. When we get to a second example of impossibility, I think it's the insurance claim where there's a fire at a business or a property. The owner files an insurance claim for $300,000. It turns out he has only a $200,000 policy, and he wants to argue that the maximum he could have imposed as a loss would be the $200,000. And the court says, no, we have the evidence of your intent right here. This is what you meant. You filled out the insurance claim. That's what we're going to go with.
Are impossibility and intent necessarily mutually exclusive? In other words, couldn't the impossibility of pulling off a heist like this bear upon Mr. Kirshner's subjective intent?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the tremendous amount of difficulty makes it quite unlikely that somebody would actually form that intent. Absolutely. I agree with you on that. That's all I had. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Judge Bibas, any questions?
Nothing further.
Counsel, thank you very much. Thanks for your briefing. Thanks for your argument. And we'll circle back to you shortly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Have a good day.